The second case has settled, so they're passing. So we'll only have the one case, which we will now hear, which is Wilder versus Campbell et al. If the clerk will please announce counsel who'll be arguing. All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Ponder, you ready?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Ponder, and I represent Tarrant County District Clerk Tom Wilder, who has been temporarily enjoined from collecting court costs assessed by judgments of particular family district courts. The injunction was granted not by those family courts, but rather by a separate district court. This court that granted the temporary injunction did not have the requisite subject matter jurisdiction in which to consider or grant an injunction due to Section 65023B of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Each of the seven named plaintiffs had previously been parties to divorce proceedings. They had each obtained judgments where court costs were assessed, and the district clerk taxed the court costs. What they argue was the amount of costs taxed against them was in error. The taxing of court costs came from the clerk due to particular phrases in their divorce judgments. The divorce judgments had one of two phrases, either one example, husband will pay his court costs, wife will pay her court costs. The second option that these individual plaintiffs had said court costs are to be paid by the party incurring same. Now, when they got their certified bill of costs, instead of pursuing the established procedure of filing motions to retax costs in the court that rendered the judgment, they instead filed a lawsuit collectively in the 17th District Court. None of the divorce cases came from the 17th District Court. They obtained temporary injunction against the district clerk from any further efforts to collect court costs on these judgments. Their suit was an injunction to stay the execution of a portion of those judgments, that portion being court costs. Section 65023B of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code states that any injunction sought to stay the execution on a judgment must be filed in that court. The only court that had the necessary jurisdiction to entertain such a request and grant that relief were the courts that rendered the judgments. The costs had been assessed, the clerk taxed the cost, and he continued to follow the rules of civil procedure to send cost bills, as the rules provide, to the parties. Separate writs of execution were not sent, but they're not necessary. Rule 129 of the Rules of Civil Procedure provides that a certified bill of costs has the force and effect of a writ of execution. This was effectively the main argument by appellees in their brief, that the absence of a formal writ of execution precludes the application of 65023B. What 65023B doesn't require a writ of execution. It states that any injunction to stay the execution, not stay a writ of execution. So collection efforts that a party, in this case the clerk, that a party would pursue would constitute execution efforts. And any attempt to stay that via injunction must come from the original court. Now, 65023B has never been applied to the particular factual scenario that we have before us. There's no case precisely on point, but it's never been limited only to instances with specific writs of execution. There are several factual scenarios that allow for or that require injunctions to stay any efforts to execute on a judgment, requiring them be filed in the court that rendered the judgment.
Well, wouldn't the additional language in B that talks about in a suit or execution on a judgment, wouldn't that be a broader interpretation of B as well?
Well, the way I read B, Your Honor, is that a suit, proceedings in a suit, it's sort of two categories.
Okay.
But I think either way, it's got to be the court that rendered the judgment. This is either an injunction, a sole injunction, or any sort of suit.
Like a turnover action.
Yeah, absolutely. It is much broader, and they use the word execution there, and it gives the impression that it might be limited to a writ of execution. But courts have never interpreted it that narrowly. But they are consistent that any of those attempts must come from the court that rendered the judgment, irrespective of whether a formal writ of execution has been issued. What they're doing with this injunction is regulating the processes of another court's judgment. And 65023B requires that that be done in the original court. Boutron versus Cantu that we cited in our brief is an example of non-writ of execution efforts that where 65023B has been applied. In that case, a party had put up a supersedious bond, then filed a separate suit requesting injunction to keep the judgment creditor from accessing that supersedious bond, and the Court of Appeals in that case held that it was that to prevent recovery of the bond was in effect to prevent recovery of the judgment. This court's opinion in Hughes v. Morgan, also cited in our brief, illustrates the point. In that case, a bail bondsman had lost his right to serve as a surety on further bonds as a result of a bond forfeiture judgment. That bondsman then sought in a separate suit an injunction against the clerk and the sheriff to allow him to continue writing bonds despite the forfeiture judgment against him. And this court held that granting that relief would effectively be setting aside the effect of a judgment of another court. The last case I want to specifically mention is Evans v. Pringle, which is a Texas Supreme Court case that had originated in Tarrant County. And this one's a little bit closer. This was another bondsman attempting to enjoin the Tarrant County Sheriff from levying on his property for an amount of the judgment that included post-judgment interest. And because his argument was that post-judgment interest could not be collected on that type of judgment. So the bondsman asked a separate court to enjoin the sheriff. And the Supreme Court held that it was a 65023B statutory predecessor, but it equally as applied that it was the regulation of the process issued under the judgment, and that only place that could be done was in the original court. And that's essentially what we have here. We have a person against whom the official attempts to levy, disagreeing with what's to be levied upon or how much is to be levied. And enjoining the attempt to collect relief must be done in the court that rendered the judgment.
Could you address Rule 145, please, and how that would affect, let's say they go back and filed in the courts where the judgments were entered? Would that not prevent collection of costs from the parties?
Well, I think that would be up to the trial court. I think that Rule 145 has a place in this analysis, but it doesn't have a place in the request for injunctive relief from a separate court. And I was about to get into this discussion of a motion to retax costs, the traditional avenue for obtaining this relief. Doing so, making that request in the trial court, the party making the point that, Your Honor, I am indigent as a matter of law by virtue of Rule 145, and these costs should not be taxed against me.
Wouldn't the court have, in the case already, have determined that the party is indigent and entitled to proceed without costs?
Yes, they would, Your Honor, but they would not have ruled upon any claim that the taxing of court costs was incorrect. That's precisely what a motion to retax costs is for, to raise that argument that, wait a minute, the taxing of court costs by the clerk was improper, either through, there's a case that says either through mistake, negligence, or omission. that in some manner the certified bill of costs that was taxed by the clerk was wrong. So, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, that rendered the judgment, please correct this. And that's, I think that's probably why we've never seen 65023B applied to the situation we have before us, because this issue where there's an alleged error in the taxing of court costs, that has to be brought and is always brought in the court that rendered the judgment via a motion to retax costs.
But the party's already been determined to be indigent and not liable for costs, and so why should they have the burden to once again come to court and go through the procedure to retax costs when it was wrong to tax them to begin with?
Well, any error in the taxing of costs must be a decision made by the trial court. The clerk's ministerial duty to tax court costs, the certified bill of costs and the act of taxing is presumed accurate unless brought before the court in a motion to retax costs. So until that's done, it's presumed correct. Now,
but the clerk knows that the party is indigent.
They do know that a Rule 145 affidavit of indigence has been filed. However, the clerk also got a judgment that said, let's presume for a minute it was the wife or the husband, let's say it's the husband that filed the costs, and knows that a Rule 145 affidavit was filed. And then the clerk was given a judgment that says husband will pay his court costs. So the clerk has effectively two somewhat inconsistent instructions. One, a presumption, and one, a direct order from the court. So the clerk has the duty to decide one way or the other. And his decision, the law views his decision as accurate and correct until that issue is brought to the trial court for discussion as to whether it was accurate or not. But nonetheless, he's given a very specific order that, for instance, and there are various versions of the assessment language in a judgment, but we do know that for these seven individuals, they were one of two ways. Husband shall pay his court costs and wife shall pay her court costs, or I'm sorry, will, not shall, will pay his court costs and will pay her court costs, or court costs are to be paid by the party who incurred them.
Does it make any difference whether the decrees of divorce were all agreed or not? I see two of them, you know, that we've got attached to your appendix here.
Well, I certainly think, Your Honor, that circumstantial support for the clerk who has before him a judgment that has been signed off on by both parties and the court with an affirmative statement regarding the payment of court costs. And the inconsistency of what may have happened months before or years before relative to a affidavit of indigence and whether it was contested or not, whether the party is deemed indigent as a matter of law, then comes along later. And it should be observed that the trial court has great discretion, particularly in family law cases. They have particular discretion to deviate from Rule 131 good cause requirement in family law cases. The authority of a family court judge to assess costs, in particular do so with the agreement of the parties, puts the clerk in an awkward position, and that position can be remedied, if necessary, by the trial court in a motion to retax costs. And I'm almost out of time, but I do want to raise the issue of any injunction has the necessary requirement of the absence of an adequate remedy at law. This motion to retax costs has always been available to them. It remains available to them. And at any time, they could file this and quickly have the relief or have their issue adjudged by the court with the proper jurisdiction.
So there's no time limitation on a motion to retax costs?
Well, the law is somewhat fuzzy on that. However, we do know it's absolutely not related to the court's traditional plenary power relative to the expiration of the judgment. What I would argue, and I think the cases discussing this have generally leaned is that it's based off of when the clerk issues the bill of costs. That any time deadline, any time the party would be stopped from asserting a motion to retax costs, that would be considered off of when the clerk got them the bill of costs. At this point, I don't think that issue's been waived. I think that they're absolutely, and I've maintained all along, that that's something they could go file today. And because that adequate remedy is there, that that precludes one of the essential elements of a temporary injunction. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ponder. Mr. Stutz, did I say your name correctly?
Stutz,
okay, thank you.
May it please the court. The district clerk's policy, as of November 2010, seeks costs against indigent per se parties, constitutes considered and a deliberate implementation of a policy that undermines the access to justice guaranteed to low-income Texans through the Constitution and through Rule 145. Judge Cleveland's temporary injunction restraining the district clerk from implementing this policy of collecting the costs from indigent Texans should be affirmed. Rule 145 has literally been around for decades. Its purpose is to ensure that low-income Texans have access to the courts. We see this today even through our former Supreme Court Justice and the current Supreme Court Justice with their emphasis on access issues. It has been historically a very important part of our jurisprudence. Going back to Equitable General versus Yates, where they say once this Rule 145 affidavit is on file, not contested or uncontestable, they are indigent per se. One case I want to point out is the Villanueva case out of Eastland, where just to show the significance of Rule 145, we see this is a case involving a SAPSR. They were trying to, the judge wanted to impose a social cost of a social study and an ad litem on an indigent per se individual. Looking at that, they said, even though we give best interest of a child is very critical in our jurisprudence, it still must give way to Rule 145 and the right to access, the fundamental right of access to a forum for indigent litigants here in Texas. What we have here, the district clerk is trying to do after the case what he cannot do before the case. When a Rule 145 affidavit is filed, it's either uncontestable because there's a certificate, or it's not contested, or it's contested and the contest is overruled. At that point, they are indigent per se. Their court costs are zero. It is a total waiver. It is not a deferral. It's a total waiver. And if the court, the district clerk, tried to compel payment of a filing fee when there's been an IOLTA, that would not stand. This is no different than that. They're going back after the fact, trying to collect costs in violation of Rule 145, which the courts have said we must give due consideration to in every variety. Perhaps the reason we haven't seen this happen before because it hasn't been tried before, this situation. That's why there's no cases on this.
But could I ask you a
sure.
question, sir?
Yes,
especially
sure.
in the family law arena, let's say you have a party who files a proper affidavit and is found to be indigent and doesn't have to pay filing fees, but that, in fact, divorce goes on for 3 years. And in the meantime, that party gets a job and is making a very good living and agrees to pay court costs in an agreed final decree of divorce. That is a possible scenario, is it not?
It's certainly a possible scenario, and I think Rule 145, Section D, takes that into consideration because if assuming whichever spouse makes the money, that's now going to become, during the divorce, it becomes community property, so it's going to have to be divided. At that point, under 145D, and this is the one exception that allows a court to invoke or make an otherwise indigent party pay costs, is if there's been an award, a monetary award, and there's sufficient monetary award that they can pay costs. At that point, they have to pay costs.
But how is the clerk supposed to know? When the clerk has an order that says somebody's indigent, and 3 years later has a decree saying the parties have to pay their court costs, how is the clerk supposed to, I mean, their duty is to follow the court's order. How is the clerk to make that decision? Well, I don't do it in this case, but I do it in that case? Shouldn't it be the trial court that makes that decision?
Justice Gabriel, I don't think so, because, and I was coming to this, is in that situation, the trial court adjudicates the costs. So in this case, these cases, the examples, the cost is to be borne by the wife, and let's say she's filed the affidavit, or the costs are borne by the party that incurred the same. The costs are zero for an indigent party, absent that finding I just talked about. The clerk, up to the clerk to tabulate the costs. The court doesn't decide, okay, you're going to pay this cost or that cost. They just say, this is how we're adjudicating it. And frankly, in this case, it may have been some boilerplate language that agreed to, but the fact is, it does not have the language of 145D that requires there be a finding of a monetary award sufficient to pay the cost. So once that court makes that agreement, under either of those scenarios, it's handed to the clerk. It is their duty to prepare and calculate the cost. That includes looking to see, is there an affidavit of indigence that would reduce their cost to zero? It would be the same thing. Let's say that husband files suit and wife files suit, but there's no affidavit of indigence, and that's all there is. At the end of the case, it says cost taxed against the party incurring the same. Well, the wife's costs are zero because she hasn't paid anything, and that's what the Rule 145 affidavit does. It makes it zero.
Of course, their position is we don't get to Rule 145 because we have this preliminary issue of 65023B. What's your best case, the best case that you have that says that we should not apply that?
That would probably be the Looney case. If the court in which the injunction suit has general jurisdiction over the subject matter, and the relief may be granted independently of the matters adjudicated in the underlying suit or processes thereunder, the restrictions of 65.023 do not apply. We are seeking mandamus. We are seeking a declaration with regard to 38. And because of the injunction's ancillary to that, but more importantly, we can grant this injunction. We're trying to enjoin a practice of collecting funds against indigent parties in violation of Rule 145. And by doing that, we can compel, the injunction was compelling the district clerk to, in evaluating costs, to follow Rule 145 at the beginning, during, and after the case. Absent that finding concerning a monetary award and sufficient funds. You know, and actually, it is a non-delegable duty in this instance, and we're not attacking the underlying judgments. We agree the divorces are fine because our position is that the judgments don't award. There's no cost to award if there's an affidavit on file, and there are in all of these cases. So we're not asking any. There's no effort to overturn those particular judgments. There's no need to invoke 65.023. Otherwise, this is an effort to deny access in the back door. And that's the policy behind Rule 145. It's been around for a while. With that, I will conclude. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Ms. DeFilippo, did I say that correctly?
DeFilippo,
almost.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Lee DeFilippo, and I represent Appellees Coleman, Campbell, and Robertson. Your Honors, the Texas Supreme Court was very clear in Equitable General Insurance versus Yates. Uncontested affidavits of inability to pay equal indigency as a matter of law equals zero court fees. Boilerplate cost assessment language does not create costs in the face of uncontested affidavits, period. I would like to address Judge Gabriel's question to Mr. Stotz, if I can. Your question was, well, what if we have a situation where someone files for divorce, is indigent at that time of filing, files an affidavit of inability to pay, it's uncontested, and then the divorce goes for 3 years, and then during that three-year time period, the person gets employed, is no longer collecting government assistance. What does the district clerk do in that case when the judgment is final, the divorce is over, and the district clerk is faced with the boilerplate cost assessment language versus this filed affidavit of inability to pay? Your Honor, according to Brown versus Clapp, the determination of indigency is made at the time of filing and not at some future speculative date. So you could have a situation where, like, somebody could get off government assistance, be thriving financially. However, that determination of indigency is made at that time, not 3 years after the divorce. I mean, at the time of divorce.
Is there a presumption that indigency continues once that affidavit is filed and not contested, or the contest is overruled? Is there a presumption through rule, statute, or case law?
Yes, Your Honor. Case law, Brown versus Clapp, as I said, that determination of indigency is made at the time of filing. And the specific words in the case is at the time of filing, not at some future speculative date. That's very, very important. That's the crux, along with the Yates case here. Your Honors, if I can, I'd like to address the order. The temporary injunction should be affirmed because Judge Cleveland did not abuse his discretion. The order is valid, specific, and complies with the mandatory procedural requirements of Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 683. In fact, it is specific with respect to the conduct to be enjoined and the irreparable injury that the community is suffering because of the actions of the district clerk. Moreover, Your Honors, I'd like to address the motion to retax remedy. It is not a remedy of law for four really important reasons. The first is that there are no costs to be retaxed. Again, I'm going to go back to the Yates case, Texas Supreme Court Yates case. Uncontested affidavits of inability to pay equal indigency as a matter of law equals zero court fees at the time of filing. Boilerplate cost assessment language does not create costs in the face of uncontested affidavits of inability to pay.
Well,
number two.
Bill of costs issued by the district clerk are also presumed to be accurate. So there are costs. They may not should have been assessed. Maybe not. But there are costs that have been assessed by the district clerk that's also entitled to a presumption of accuracy. Is that not the law as well?
Well, Your Honor, our contention is the district clerk is violating his non-discretionary ministerial public duty by assessing court fees in excess of zero when you have a litigant who is indigent as a matter of law. So there's a breach of duty there. And that's what we are not attacking the judgments. The judgments, as far as we're concerned, are fine and accurate. I mean, the judgments are the judgments. We're not attacking that. We're attacking the district clerk's duty to properly create a cost bill based on everything that's in the file. I mean, the affidavits of inability to pay are processed through the district clerk's office.
So are the judgments. I mean, it just really puts the district clerk in an awkward position. He's got conflicting orders from a judge telling him to do two different things. You want him to pick one, understandably, but...
Your Honor, if I may, the district clerk does not have discretion. It's a non-discretionary ministerial public duty to, in the face of an uncontested affidavit of inability to pay, there aren't any court fees.
Is it not a ministerial duty to issue a bill of costs when the trial court says that the party shall or will or are to pay costs?
Not in the, my position is, Your Honor, not in the face of an uncontested affidavit of inability to pay. That's a breach of his non-discretionary ministerial public duty. If I may get back to the motion to retax, number two, why that's not an adequate remedy of law. The district clerk's actions are intentional and deliberate. Motion to retax is a remedy when you have the district clerk making an error based on mistake, omission, or negligence. That's not what we have here. We have intentional and deliberate taxing or collecting of court fees from indigent litigants. Number three, it would be an incredible waste of judicial and public resources to have X amount, I mean, hundreds if not thousands of indigent litigants flood the courts with motions to retax. And may I also add that these folks, my clients, were pro se litigants. My colleagues' clients went through legal aid. So are we really going to ask these folks to know what a motion to retax is and come to the court and file those motions and expect to, you know, without, even if every legal aid attorney in this whole state of Texas did that, it probably still wouldn't provide relief for everybody that was wrongfully billed. The last point, Your Honors, is the fact that, okay, what do we do for a motion to retax for the people that paid these fees? I have a client who's already paid $75 wrongfully to the district clerk. That motion to retax is limited to people who have not paid their court fees. There's a case called Operation Rescue versus Planned Parenthood. It's only a remedy when the district clerk makes an error, omission, and engaging in negligence, and the party has not paid. So what do we do with all the people that have paid?
The injunction doesn't help those people either.
Correct, Your Honor, but that's just to maintain the status quo to prevent further damage to the community while our case is pending. Why collect more fees while we want to just maintain the status quo until we can get to the merits of the case?
But aren't those some of the reasons why class action would have been appropriate?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I amended my pleading, and I think you may have a copy of that in front of you. I amended my pleading to include a class action. We have a class action certification hearing on November 11th, and I specifically did that to seek reimbursement for all the people that have paid. But to address that, you don't need a class certification to get a temporary injunction. I forget the name of the case off the top of my head. That it's in my brief, but you can proceed with a temporary injunction without getting class certification. I remember.
All right, I believe your time has concluded.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your time. Yes.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right, Mr. Ponder.
I think there was an important comment made there that evidence is a real fundamental disagreement amongst the parties. And that's referring to the language in the judgment as boilerplate cost assessment language. Well, boilerplate to one person is a direct order from the court to another. And the very difficult position, as Justice Gabriel, you identified, that the clerk is in by having these contradictory orders, one finding that a party is indigent as a matter of law, that presumption continues, as Justice Gardner identified. Then subsequent to that, sometimes long subsequent to that, an affirmative finding by the court, a direct ruling, an order, that the party will pay her court costs. Now, under 145D, is that an error? Has the trial court failed to include the specific finding? I don't know. But is that the clerk's job to correct the trial court and say, Your Honor, you assessed costs. You said the party is to pay them. However, you didn't have the proper notation in the judgment. You didn't conduct the necessary hearing on actual ability to pay at the end of the case. So I will not do it, Your Honor, as the clerk. That is a very uncomfortable position for the district clerk. And in fact, those types of errors are identified all the time, and they're brought to the attention of the appellate court. The appellate court is presented as notice of appeal that the court erred in assessing the language when they didn't have take all the necessary steps to do so. But whose job is it to point that out to the trial court? Is it the clerk, or is it another judicial body where the jurisprudential system is set up to correct those errors? The clerk's non-discretionary ministerial duty is to tax the court costs. Not to tax them in a way that the parties would like, but the clerk has the obligation to do what they believe is accurate, what the court has ordered. And if further in time, closer in time to when he's doing the cost, there's an absolute unequivocal statement by the trial judge, agreed to by the parties, that they will pay the court cost, it's not unreasonable to suggest that the clerk might do a cost bill consistent with that order. And it's presumed accurate. And there is an established, always available remedy. And in fact, it's a remedy that's been utilized by lots of folks. Have gone in, filed the motion to retax costs, and I wouldn't represent to the court their success rate on those motions, but they're getting quick and efficient justice for their question. They're not waiting 7 months, 8 months for an improper injunction case to proceed through the court system and ultimately maybe get their relief. And that's the inefficiency in this. The efficiency is going directly to the court that's there, filing the motion, and within a few days getting your relief. That's efficiency.
Yeah, when you look at 145D, it really doesn't say who is supposed to step forward and say that some party is now able to pay costs. Is it just the judge's determination?
That's exactly
sua
right.
Sponte?
Absolutely.
Based on the division of property or the monetary award?
And given the given the unique nature of family court proceedings, where the subject often, if not always, of the litigation is division of the property, that judge is in the most unique position of evaluating the assets, the liabilities, who has an ability to pay. More so in a family court than in any other court. And 145D gives him that authority. And there's a great amount of discretion given to the trial court to decide who will pay the cost. And if courts are going to be overtaken by clerks because the judge hasn't followed all of the necessary steps, then I don't think that serves the judicial community or the populace in that way.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Justice.
I'm reading from the language of D, Rule 145, about in the middle of that subsection. It sounds like, or it reads like, the rule is saying that if the court, it does say, if the court finds at the first regular hearing in the course of the action that the party is able to afford costs, and I'm assuming it's referring back to a party who has been found indigent or has not, their indigency affidavit has not been contested, the party must pay the cost of the action, but it says reasons for such a finding must be contained in an order. Except with leave of court, no further steps in the action will be taken.
Justice Gardner, that's actually the preliminary finding if a contest is filed.
Okay.
That would be if continue to answer the question. That would be if the party files their affidavit of indigence at the beginning of the case, in most instances, the clerk then contests, or one of the parties contests, the affidavit. Then at the first regular hearing, a determination is made, and those are the procedures for the preliminary assessment. But further down in subsection D are the little bit of additional authority for the court through the normal developments. Things change. Litigation takes a long time. It's just the nature of the beast. And prospects, financial prospects of individuals change, and maybe in no greater setting than in family court.
Well, is it the indigent party's burden, under your theory, to come forward and say, now I can pay costs?
I don't think it's their burden, Your Honor. I think that would be one of the I think that would be up to the court to do sua sponte, or one of the parties to raise. I don't believe that by that point, at the end of the litigation, the clerk doesn't have much role in this. The clerk gets a judgment that says Mr. Smith will pay his court costs. And at that point, what's been done to support or substantiate that decision or that order is already taken place.
Okay. I had a couple more, but I won't take up the time.
Are you sure?
Well, the presumption under the family code in, say, termination cases of indigency is presumed to continue on into the appeal. So what about in a case like that? We've got a presumption of indigency. Why doesn't that control? And what about the argument that, the court tax costs against party incurring same or court taxes costs, let's say that language. Why wouldn't the costs be zero under, and that wouldn't that wouldn't that solve the problem of the conflict between a judgment taxing costs and a determination of indigency?
Well, Your Honor, I let me address the first question, and that's this presumption. I absolutely agree that the law is quite clear that once you have an affidavit of indigence that's either not contested or a contest that's denied, they are indigent and remain so unless there is some contradictory circumstance that changes. And if these judgments did not have particular findings or particular orders that this party will pay the court costs, there would have been no court cost tax against them. This is not a policy, as they may be suggesting, that no matter what the judgment reads, that the clerk is going to tax the court costs against them. That's absolutely not true. The only cases that get a certified bill of costs served on them by virtue of the motion to or the taxing of court costs are those with affirmative statements to pay the court costs. And in these seven who are the named parties, they had that, and as I've mentioned several times, what those affirmative statements are, and they're quite firm. They're not, they don't sort of go back and forth, it doesn't vacillate. It is quite strong in its argument. But I want to make clear that this presumption carried up until the point where the judge said they're going to pay. And the clerk is left to, and in the somewhat unenviable position, to say, well, it appears that they were indigent right up until the judge found that they had the ability to pay. And was there evidence in the record substantiating that fact? That's frankly not up to the clerk, I would argue. And he should act accordingly. Did that answer the question,
yes,
it Justice
does.
Garner?
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Ponder.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for all of your arguments. We appreciate all of you being here, and we also appreciate all of your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused, and we will now adjourn court. Thank you.